Abate la rimette dentro, esce Radu, porta vuota. Gol! Gol! Abbiamo battuto il gatto nero! Li abbiamo battuti tutti, Alessio! Grande Alessio! È bella la vita! Lava quella zolla, Alessio! Lava la quella zolla, Alessio!
Hello everyone and welcome to another episode of the Sempre Milan podcast. I'm your host, Ollie Fisher. You can find me on Twitter at Ollie Fisher, joined once again by Anthony Torgrude.
Hey guys, it's me, Anthony. I would say happy to be here, but it's not fun talking about this team anymore. But, you know, we're here, so follow me on Twitter, Torgrude45. Madison's joined us as well.
Yeah, same as AJ. It's getting pretty repetitive here, talking about all of our problems. But you guys can go ahead and follow me on Twitter at Madison_DT.
Yeah, lovely positive start to this podcast as always. But, you know, as the lads say there, we don't really have much choice at the moment other than to be a little bit down. This is one of those weird ones where we have two games to review. And the first one was a win and a clean sheet. Not great, but obviously you would say important psychologically at the time. And we got a second game to review, which has kind of just put a downer on everything again. So really, there's no point going into much depth about the first game. But it was a win over Spal. Of course, Suso had been under huge pressure in sort of the few days running up to the game. He's in poor form. It was understandable that the fan base were getting a bit irritable with who's meant to be our main creative player. Naturally, he came off the bench, scored a trademark free kick, I would call it, in the 62nd or 63rd minute, I think it was. And we go on to win 1-0. It wasn't vintage, AJ, but it looked like it was at least a step in the right direction, a win under Pioli.
Yeah, you know, it was our first win under Pioli, which that alone is upsetting because Lecce really should have been it. But regardless, Suso was benched, came off, like you said, scored that free kick. So we all kind of were like, okay, you know, maybe he's been in poor form, but he's still obviously better than the alternative. And then we'll get to that later, what happened there with Lazio. So, you know, there all the positives that you could take from the Spal game just kind of went away overnight, it seemed. And yeah, I mean, there's really not much commentary to it. It was an overall very boring game up until the one free kick goal.
Yeah, I definitely agree. And it kind of seems to be the story so far this season. The games that we are winning are very boring and not very entertaining games. And then, you know, against Torino, we had a really good game, but we lost. And Lecce, we scored more than one goal, but then we tied. And just kind of seems to be the story so far.
Yeah, it does seem to be that we can't really get the balance right. Either we play with an open, expansive style and look very susceptible to conceding at the back, or we play, you know, our worst games creatively, like we did against Brescia and Hayes Verona earlier in the season, and rack up wins by a goal. But there were a few positives from it. One thing I will say is that Duarte started the game as a right back, obviously coming in for Davide Calabria and Andrea Conti, who had obviously made mistakes in the previous two games. But he started at right back and then got shifted inside because of an injury to Musaccio. Duarte, for his first start, looked pretty good, I would say.
Was that a question?
Yeah, it was more of a statement.
It was a tentative statement.
No, I agree, though. Duarte definitely looked good and obviously got the start at Lazio, which was a muscular problem for Musaccio, not really just a you-earned-it kind of deal. But he looked good in both games. I definitely liked having him on the pitch. You know, he brings a new added level of height that we don't have in our back line. His positioning isn't as good as it could be yet, but that'll just come with time. And, you know, I don't foresee him being the answer to our defensive problems moving forward, but it definitely was nice to know that our substitutes are better than not having a player on the pitch, you know, because some positions we just don't really have a backup for. And like when we put on, for example, a backup right back or any right back lately, we might as well be playing with 10 men. So it was nice to know that our backup center back was not a hindrance so much as it was actual help.
Yeah, that's a very fair point. I mean, Duarte was one of those purchases that we sort of said as well could go either way. You know, he was kind of brought in ideally as a replacement for Zapata, somebody who wasn't intended to be in the starting lineup, but if things were going badly or we had injuries or suspensions, then he could slot in there. And he looked fairly reliable in that role. And Teo Hernandez had another good game as well. I'd say he was probably one of the brightest player on the pitch creatively. You know, his speed going forward, and his ability to cut inside from the left actually seems to open teams up, and we look the most dangerous from those positions. So that was pretty good. It was 3 points.
I think the biggest downside for Teo is he's so much faster than everyone else that when he's in a position to where now it's time to either move the ball to someone else or take the shot, there's no teammates around to support him. You know, they're still trying to catch up. He's just so fast. And I guess that's a good problem to have, you know, but he's absolutely, you're right. He's been the only bright spot of the entire season, really, in my opinion.
He has, yeah. I would say that's probably about right. We know where we stand with Teo. And I mean, we'll kind of, we'll use this as a segue now into the Lazio game, I guess. We lost 2-1 on Sunday night. Obviously, we record on Monday nights. It was billed by a lot of people as a potential launching point of the season again against a team that we hadn't lost at home against in the league for 30 years. It's a team that we seem to always beat at home, no matter how bad we are, at least in Serie A. And I guess it's just a perfect indication of how historically bad this start to the season has been. I wouldn't say we were battered by any means. I wouldn't say Lazio were fully deserving of the 3 points, but they got it. Immobile scored again, that was kind of a trademark header from him, peeling off at the near post. Duarte could have done a little bit better, in my opinion, just to stay tight to his man there. But, of course, then as well, Joaquin Correa, I think that's how you say it, I'm not sure. But a guy we were linked with in the summer, and a guy who, AJ, you've repeatedly said we should be looking at signing, you know, over the other Correa, Angel Correa. But he was the one who scored the winner after the own goal equaliser. They hit us on the break somehow in the 83rd minute. I don't understand how we managed to get hit on the break in the 83rd minute of a 1-1 game. I understand we had two strikers on the pitch at that point because Leao had come on for Paqueta and we still had Piontek on. But it was just an incisive ball that caught Hernandez out of position again. And he was way out of position as well for the first goal, allowing Lazzari to cross for Immobile's header. So that's where we are with Hernandez. He can't defend.
Now, on that goal, there's more blame to hand out than just Hernandez. Not saying he doesn't deserve it, because he absolutely does. But if you go back and watch it, you know, Teo, I think it is Teo who gets the ball at some point on that breakaway and goes to clear it. And it goes right over Romagnoli to Correa, who then just stands still and lets it happen. I don't know if he thought Duarte was back there, one of the midfielders were back there or something, but he just absolutely stopped moving and let Correa get the ball and then run past him. And when someone's already in stride and you're at a dead stop, you're just never going to catch them, ever. No. And then with Teo already being out of position and then Duarte having to run across from, you know, the opposite side there, so it was just a perfect recipe for disaster there. I think if Romagnoli wouldn't have that brain fart, I think he would have been able to cover for Teo's mistake. And obviously, if Teo never made that mistake, that we're never in the position to begin with. But it was just, it was really disappointing to see that. That was something from our captain that we're not used to. We're used to having really good performances, at worst, you know, a 6.5 out of 10. So to see him make a rookie-level mistake like that was a lot more frustrating for me than to see Teo do it, who's someone we know is a lot more poor in defense than he is in offense. So, I don't know. That one really just dug the nail in the coffin for me. That one hurt. But you're right. This was someone I was craving us to sign. And when the first news that we were going for Angel Correa came out, I read Correa and said, oh, shit, this is perfect. Joaquin Correa is dope. And then I read the article and it said, oh, no, wrong one. And then it went on all season, so of course it was him. It had to be him, and that was when I just fell silent for the rest of the game. I didn't say a word, and it ended. I got left.
I was kind of in disbelief that happened, but you could just feel it coming. I feel like as soon as Paqueta got off the field, our game changed a little bit because he was really helping us push forward, and it was just a disappointing game because I thought that this was one of our better games played, except for the two lapses in defense.
Yeah, that's a good point you bring up with the the substitution of Paqueta there, because I wasn't fond of our substitutions really at all in this game. Obviously, mm-hmm. the Castillejo sub coming off, it had to be done. He got injured, and now it's looking like he might be out for quite some time, which is a bummer because he looked fantastic. And I've never said that. In fact, I've only insulted and battered this man for everything mm-hmm. I possibly could.
Yeah.
But he looked great. And to see him get injured was a real blow. And then Rebic came on, and everyone was like a little excited. You know, we're like, well, cool. At least we'll get Rebic now. You know, we've been clamoring for it. And I think we all agree that he put in like a 1 out of 10, a 2 out of 10 at best. I mean, he was god-awful.
He was good for the first, I would say, 3 minutes after coming on. And then things just went so quickly downhill. I mean, I don't know if you saw that, what... I can't remember who said it earlier. It's a guy who used to play for us. Stefano Aranio basically came out and said that he thinks that that Rebic is about 4 kilograms overweight. He said that he thinks that Rebic has put on 4 kilograms since we played in Verona, which would be obscene, really. Like, I don't know how that would happen. But he did kind of look a bit sluggish. He didn't look sharp and made poor decisions. And you're right, there was a lot of... Certainly a lot of questions being asked by the fan base about how we've only seen up until that point about 75 minutes of him in action in Serie A for us. And, you know, I've been one of those who was vocally saying if I was him, I'd be asking to leave in January if things don't improve, because it's a bit insulting to see someone like Castillejo start over you on the right wing, although Castillejo did have a good game, as you say. But then, yeah, Rebic came on and just did not help. I thought he really would help, because he's one of those wingers who is absolutely desperate to get on the ball and run at his man. And it just never materialised for him. And I think we should be a little bit worried about that. We perhaps don't have the depth of winger that we thought that we had.
Real quick, because I think the majority of our listeners are American-based, so probably have no idea what a kilogram is or what the conversion is.
Yeah.
4 kilograms is about 9 pounds.
It's not a huge amount, but I think it makes a big difference when professional
does.
Athletes are supposed to monitor their weight. And one of the big things that Pioli was supposed to have instilled is a new like dietary regime about the players all eating together for breakfast and lunch / dinner, whatever you call it. And then obviously evening meals they leave to themselves. And it looks like Rebic has been cheating on those evening meals a little bit.
Too much pasta in Italy there, man.
Yeah, it might well be.
Honestly, that's something you see with foreign players a lot when they go to Italy. All of a sudden, they're carbo loading on pasta, and then now they're slower.
well, that is a joke, but it is true.
Like they actually, it is good energy food, absolutely, but not if you're having it every night. Like you want to have that, you know, like the night before a game training, or the lunch before, something like that. Yeah. But not dinner the night before bed.
No, I thought that was an interesting one, though. I don't know how he's got access to that knowledge, but he said, yeah, since the Verona game, so I can't remember how long ago that was now. That was the third game of the season, I think it was. He's put on
He hasn't played since then either, so his confidence is at a low. His probable training is probably lesser than you know, when he started. Like, he's thinking, well, I'm not going to play. You know, what's the point of pushing myself in training? So I get it. I absolutely see how you could do that, but you're right. As a professional athlete, like, this is your job. You need to keep your body in tip-top shape and always be where you're at.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we'll see now, because obviously, as you mentioned, Castillejo's injured. We got an interesting question from Torin Svensson. He said, with Samu getting injured, which is obviously a massive shame, those who haven't seen, he's got a lesion in his right, I want to say hamstring? Or is it his thigh, maybe? No, I think it is his hamstring. I can't remember. But basically, had an MRI scan. They're going to have to do another scan on it in 10 days, and then they'll be able to assess how long the recovery is going to be. I've seen a couple people who know more than me on this kind of thing say that you're looking at, you know, a month to 40 days out with an injury like this, depending on the grade of tear and stuff like that.
How long Suso is out? Was this just a one-game absence?
It looks like just being a one game, as far as I know. Okay. It was just, I think that was muscle tightness that he got on the Saturday before the game. So he should hopefully be back for Juve, hopefully. But yeah, this question was good. Do you think that we'll go for an experienced right winger now that we don't really apparently have much depth on that side anymore? I mean, we might get Castillejo back before January, but obviously is he an option for us going forward, or do we need to dip back into the transfer market to get another right winger? Maybe sell Sousa?
It's tough because I felt like we haven't had depth there ever, you know? But I don't know if we need to sign anyone. I think we have other problem areas that are more dire. Yeah. Did we just use the exact same word choice?
We did.
That's weird. Yeah, but good job. I like it. Yeah, but there's just other positions that are more important right now, and I think Suso's reliable enough. I mean, this is one of... He's probably had, like, what, less than 5 injuries his whole time with us that he's missed games from? I mean, that's probably wrong, but I can't remember the last time before this. So I think he's reliable enough to be there and, you know, put in a decent shift or decent to good shift while we focus on things that are more important, like our right back issue. I mean, that whole right side is weak. Our right back, our right
wing. You know,
right
everyone
mid.
Is shitting on the right back and Calabria, but he had a good season last season. Everyone is having a shitty season this season. We can't be so quick to replace him when the entire team is out of form. He's just getting the brunt of all of the insults, like Suso was as well. I think give the team till January. Sue, who is starting to get their form back. You can already tell in the last 3 games under Pioli, the team is becoming more of themselves again. Even in this last game, Piontek still looked like trash, but you could tell that he was starting to get his confidence back. His touch on the ball is still horrible, but you could start to see like his positioning and all that stuff come back to him a little bit more. So I don't think we need to be so quick to replace Calabria. Maybe buy a backup to drive competitive, you know? But I don't think that we need to be so quick to replace him.
AJ, I just want to congratulate you. I've just looked up Suso's injury record. He's had 5 injuries with us, and he has missed a total of 9 games so far in the...
Well,
it's since the 16-17 season, basically.
So since he returned from Genoa, then?
Yeah, and that includes the one game that he's currently missed as of this spell. So, yeah, good knowledge. Yeah, you touched on a good point there. We got a question from Christian Espinosa who said, what in the world has happened to Piontek? He looks so bad and he's useless in the build-up play. He didn't look like this last year. Do you still believe in him and that he'll pick up his play, or should we sell him while he still has some value? I agree with Maddie's assessment to an extent. I think in the first, I want to say the first 30 minutes against Lazio, he looked pretty good. Again, though, that was with him dropping in. I mean, sometimes he was picking up the ball around about the halfway line and he's just not going to do any damage there. Like, he's not then... I don't know, he's not then one of them strikers who's just going to make a beeline for the 18-yard box and get on the end of a cross. It doesn't seem that way anyway. Whereas perhaps last season when he was playing with a lot more confidence, he was like that, but he was picking up the ball in a lot more dangerous areas and his touch was much better. And I don't know, we've said multiple times since the summer that our worries were that Piontek was a one-season wonder last season. We started to see it towards the end of last season when he scored like 1 goal in his last 8 games, I think it was. And I think our fears are perhaps starting to get a bit confirmed now. I don't think Piontek had a terrible game against Lazio and obviously had a hand in the goal. It wasn't given to him in the end. It was given to Bastos.
Did they overturn that?
Yeah, they switched it back to being a Bastos. Well, basically, someone tweeted that it had officially been given to Piontek, but then it has been given as a Bastos own goal. Then there was just a debate on whether he got a toe on it there, and if he did, you know, whether it was going on target and got deflected, whatever. There's a few different factors towards.
Yeah, I think goal, it was aiming towards the opposite post that it went in from. So I think that's... I mean, I said when it happened that it should be a Bastos own goal, but I thought it was given to Piontek, so I was thrilled about that. But, yeah, I mean, just to touch on that, my assessment of Piontek and the way I've been looking at this season so far is kind of in 2 chapters, you know. We have the Gianpaolo chapter, now the Pioli chapter. And like you said, we were worried that Piontek wasn't going to continue his world-class form into this season. And I never expected him to get those that what did he have last season? 36 or 38 goals, something like that?
I think 35.
No, it was 22 in Serie A.
No, but overall, he was well over
30. Oh, including the, in everything, I think he hit like 35 goals.
Okay, yeah. So right around there, and I didn't anticipate him to get those numbers again this season, especially without having the third competition, but I didn't expect a drop-off this heavy. You know, I still expected decent numbers from him in the teens, maybe. But my issue is when Gianpaolo came in, he was now expected to be the main striker in a two-striker formation, with the second striker being the creative guy, the one that's going to do stuff. So mm-hmm. Piontek's job was quite literally to stand in the box, wait for the ball, and tap it in. And
mm-hmm. Or no at least sort of give us a chance, like in the Atalanta game last season, where he kind of scored out of nowhere, but it was a good right. delivery and he was there, you know, not always tap-ins, but just to be instinctive in the penalty area.
Yes, exactly. Just more of a poacher, pure striker style. Mm-hmm. But no one in the team was able to really mesh with that change of formation. I mean, that's what started Suso's downslide this season, was trying to force him into a role that he was never going to play, that at least myself and many other fans that I know of said he can never play this position. I believe you guys are in that boat as well. And then there was other players getting thrown around in spots that they shouldn't have been. And so then we obviously saw what happened with Gianpaolo, brought the morale down. Pioli comes in, he says, let's go back to what we did last season that was successful. Let's just find ourselves, get back to it. And so we are slowly seeing this steady rise back in form, back to almost where we were. But because we've had this tough spell of games and we're still on it, we're not going to see those results yet, unfortunately. But we're seeing the players kind of get back there. And so far, it's just a climb back to last season. It's not an improvement. We're not getting better than that. Right now, the bar is just set at, let's get back to how we were playing last season, because this Gianpaolo experiment was not long enough, and it was too difficult to start with the time that we had, and it failed, and this is where we're at now. So I don't know. I don't hold anything from those first seven games against anyone on the team, including Suso and Piontek, but now I just think it's an uphill battle to get back to where you were.
Yeah, I agree with you, because I think the big difference between the two managers and the way that they wanted to use Piontek was pretty cut and dry. Gianpaolo wanted him to be a complete striker and wanted him to contribute to the play, and if that meant dropping deeper, then so be it. Whereas Pioli made it clear that he wanted him to stick in and around the penalty area and, as you say, be more of a pure centre-forward, a finisher, a poacher. We've seen that in glimpses, I would say, under Pioli, who, of course, you've got to remember, has only had four games, really, to work with this team. So, in theory, shouldn't be judged just yet, but it didn't stop people judging Gianpaolo, I guess, although he did have the preseason to work with the team. But I also just think that we're simply not creating enough chances for him. You know, we're getting into good positions, but we seem to do this thing as well. And this is where my gripe comes in with Paqueta, who I think is starting to attract what I would say is a fair amount of criticism. He seems to get the ball, or he seems to be the one who has the ball when we're in break situations or we win the ball with our high press, and he always seems to make the wrong decision, and often that involves Piontek making good runs in behind that he doesn't see because he's trying to spray the ball out wide, or he goes for a shot himself, or, you know, most of the time misplaces a pass. There was one in the game against Lazio where he drilled the ball straight at the back of Piontek's heel. And it was like, well, that's not, you know, it's not going to help anyone. The execution's not there. That could have been a goal-scoring opportunity. And the times that Piontek does get the ball inside the area, it always seems to be weirdly from a narrow angle, and he always seems to shoot into the side netting. But, you know, Liao's also been guilty of that as well. We've seen that when he started as a centre-forward. So I don't think we're creating enough dangerous goal-scoring opportunities. And the more that they increase, the more that Piontek's goals scored will increase. And we've seen that against Lecce? Yeah, Lecce, when he came off the bench and scored with pretty much the first decent opportunity he got inside the area all season that wasn't a penalty. And until we start literally laying the ball on a plate for him and he starts scoring more goals from open play, I really, really don't see what else he can bring to the table. And then that brings you to, well, the alternative's Rafael Leao. And we've not seen anything really from him in the last three games either. You know, he had that amazing solo goal against Fiorentina And we'd seen, you know, bright sparks from him in a few games prior to that, but only glimpses, you know, nothing absolute world beater stuff. And said on here, we've got to be careful. We can't overhype the kid and put the weight of the season on his shoulders because he's 20 years old. And lo and behold, what's happened? It seemed the pressure seems to have kind of got to him, and he was basically out of that game on Sunday night. And I don't know. It feels like the solutions aren't there to fix our problems up front at the moment. I mean,
the issue with Liao is he's immature. I mean, Maddie's touched on it quite a bit. He makes a lot of childish decisions. Like you said with Paqueta, it's decision making. Liao kind of has the same issue, but he also has that pressure of like, okay, I got to make something, you know, and that's our fault, the fans. We put that on him. And now he goes forward and he tries to create something because he thinks I'm the only one who has the ability to. So he's doing fancy flicks, step overs, spins, all kind of things that don't work out, you know? And so it's hurting the team more than it's helping it at this point. I think he's a phenomenal player and is going to do great things, but he's too young right now and he needs to take a step back, you know?
He does. And we are guilty of a lot of things as a fan base. I use that as a collective because obviously there's a few differing views inside the fan base itself, but of sort of players who show even the littlest thing, and we've become so used to average and below average that it doesn't take much to get us excited anymore. And obviously a goal like that one that he scored against Fiorentina is going to get people on the edge of their seats. It's going to get people excited and be like, well, this is what we spent 30 million euros on. But then, you know, performances like the last couple that Ismael Benacer's had, they were good performances, don't get me wrong, and he showed the fight and he showed the warrior spirit that you expect from somebody who puts on the Milan shirt, but they were probably 7 out of 10s at best. And all of a sudden, you know, he's the new Gattuso and stuff like that. It's just the reactionary nature of football fans, I guess, but us more so than most because we've become so used to mediocrity, I guess. And it doesn't help having such a young squad when, you know, if one of them starts to show something, of course they happen to be 20 or 21 years old, and that's just the way it is. And the players that you would look to now as leaders, because they're a little bit older than the rest, the likes of Suso, the likes of Rebic, the likes of Romagnoli and Musaccia, who would, you know, in that mid-20s to late-20s range, when they don't perform, it's like, well, we're absolutely helpless because we cannot be relying on players that are still eligible for under-20 international teams. It's just not going to work. But we're guilty of potentially going around in circles and saying, this is where we went wrong in the summer, in not adding experienced players that, you know, we're going to lead by example, both in terms of having played at an elite level for a long amount of time, and lead by example with performances. We just don't have that at the moment. And a number of pundits have come out during the week, particularly after the Lazio game, and said we're a team that's devoid of leaders. And there's been a few rumbles about players who could potentially arrive to fix that problem. But, you know, for the time being, we've got a group here that's we're going to have to accept they're going through a lot of growing pains. And for the time being, at least, that means that we're in the bottom half of the table. And of course, in fitting fashion, what's our next game? Juventus away. So that's going to be fun. I honestly, this is one of those games that I actually don't really want to spend too much time previewing. It's basically a guaranteed loss every season. They're fighting for the Scudetto with Inter, it looks like, because Atalanta and Napoli just aren't really, you know, picking up the points at the same rate as the top two at the moment. AJ, I'm guessing you're pretty pessimistic as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's not a chance. In fact, I had tweeted immediately after the last game. I tweeted a poll. I said predictions for Juve Milan and got 160 votes. And the options were embarrassing loss or really embarrassing loss. And the winner with 63% of the votes was really embarrassing loss. So it doesn't sound like anyone's too optimistic about this one here. And
well, when you do that directly after a loss,
yeah, you're going to get, I guess.
Oh, yeah. And I was pandering 100%. But I would be satisfied with a 1-0 loss, honestly. Like, if we could just contain them, that'd be chill. I don't expect us to win. I don't expect us to draw. A draw, I'd be overjoyed, honestly. If we could pull that off, great. because that's a point no one expects you to take. So, yeah, there's nothing really even to preview.
No, you're right. I mean, I'm looking at Juve's results here, and I knew that there were people who were saying that they hadn't hit second gear yet under Sarri, which is, I guess, understandable. He has a very precise way of how he wants to play, and it took him time to embed that at Chelsea. In fact, it took him a long time, to the extent that even as late as before Christmas, they were chanting that they wanted him out and F Sarri ball.
They did win their
first
games under him, though.
Yes, they started well, didn't they? And then things kind of fell off a little bit. But yeah, then eventually by the end of the season, I think it'd be fair to say won around a fair few Chelsea fans by winning a trophy and by, you know, getting them up into the top four. Is that right? Did he get them in the top four?
They won
Europa League. That's
but
the
I
one.
Do you think they finished top four, didn't they?
I honestly can't remember. But anyway, they're in the Champions League, basically, and that was kind of one of the big things for Chelsea fans, understandably. And they're in there, but obviously he ended up going and Lampard's doing an all right job there. Sarri's at Juve, and I didn't realise that this was the case, but in Serie A,
Third last year, sorry.
Okay, that's not bad at all. In Serie A, they've only won one game by more than one goal, and that was a 2-0 home win over Spal. The rest of the games, they've won by one goal. But they've drawn only two of them. So they're in good form, but they're winning games narrowly, even against, you know, the likes of Parma, Brescia, Bologna. It took a last-minute penalty for them to beat Genoa the game before they went to Torino and won with a 70th-minute header. So, you know what I mean? They don't seem as invincible as they did under Allegri. But at the same time, they haven't lost a game yet this season, and I don't expect us to be the first team to inflict defeat on them. I mean, in the Champions League, they looked a little bit better. I mean, they rescued a point. Or rather, sorry, they were 2-0 up at Atletico Madrid and ended up drawing 2-2. They beat Bayer Leverkusen 3-0, and then they came from behind against Lokomotiv Moscow to beat them 2-1. So they basically haven't lost a competitive game yet this season, which doesn't bode very well. I mean, we got a question here, which is, I suppose, one of those where you're going to have to take a stab in the dark, really. But Joseph Calvo asks, who's the one player that you expect more out of against Juve? Which player needs to have a breakout game in order for us to have a shot at winning the game? I'm going to throw that to you because I need to wrap my brains here.
I loved this question. I think he actually asked the first one as soon as we tweeted it. But what player are we expecting more out of? I'm going to say I expect more out of Paqueta because it's a team that he can really be challenged against. And who needs to have a breakout game? It is going to be Piontek. And, guys, I honestly think that we could win this one 1-0. Just saying.
I mean, a broken clock's right twice a day, Maddie. You keep voting for a win. We'll get one eventually, so keep it up.
I threw for a loss against Lazio and a win against Spal, just saying.
Did you really? Wow.
I did.
You did. You did. I remember that, yeah.
I did a 2-1 loss.
Yeah. I'm going to feel maybe not controversial, but change it up a little bit. Who do I expect more from this game? Donnarumma. He's easily our best player this season on our squad, but he's going to be put to work this weekend. And I expect him to show up. I don't want him to, you know, come in with the same mentality that we have that is, well, we've already lost, you know, because when you come in with that and you're the goalkeeper, you're conceding goals. He's going to have a lot of shots on him, and I fully expect him to, you know, show up and ace the test. He may not keep a clean sheet, probably won't, but I absolutely expect a lot from him, more so in this game than other games. Who needs a breakthrough performance to win? Shit, honestly, probably Donnarumma too. You know, if he could just keep those balls out of the net, then maybe we could sneak by something, but it'll be rough. And we're not getting a penalty. We already know that's impossible against
Juve.
No,
we're not. We'll probably concede one.
Yeah, we'll get one given against us.
Oh, yeah, Klopp getting a red card for sure.
No, this is a good question because I guess what it ultimately comes down to in a more simple sense is like trying to pick your match winner, basically. And it's difficult when you don't see us actually winning the match. But this game's going to go one of either two ways. We're either going to try and play tight, try and contain, sit the midfield deep in front of the back four and frustrate them as much as possible and try to exploit the occasional counter-attack. And I think if we do that, we're going to lose by the odd goal, just like Juve have won most of their games this season, bar one. The other approach would be to play much more open, much more expansive, as we did early on against Roma. I think if we do that, that gives us our only chance of winning, but that would be very much the broken clock being right twice a day thing that AJ said. We'd basically have to win in a shootout by doing that, and we don't look to be finishing our chances that well at the moment. And also, I'd say it could leave us wide open at the other end, as it did against Roma, and that's where I worry that they could stick two or three past us. So this is a tough one. I think, who do I expect more out of? I'm going to agree and say Paqueta. I think if he can have that breakout game that we're still kind of waiting for, if he can put in a man of the match performance and look confident on the ball and look to, you know, to break through the thirds and to be our main creative force, like we've been expecting him to be since he arrived for 35 million euros, and he can respond to the critics in the way that Suso did, then I think we're going to be somewhere there or thereabouts. But we, like I say, we haven't really seen it from him yet. We've not seen him put in a performance for 90 minutes, which you would consider to be what he's capable of or what he has the potential of. So it is going to come, though, eventually. It is going to come because you can see the talent's there. And I just think he needs something to go for him early in the game. So it might well be that we win the ball with our high press, you know, take advantage of the fact that their back line's a little bit sluggish and Paqueta bangs one in from the edge of the box. And it's like, right, here we go. We can do something today. But I always do this where I talk myself into thinking we have even half a chance of winning away at Juve, but I don't see it happening. I'm predicting us to lose this probably 1-0, a goal in the second half from someone, but yeah, 1-0. Predictions, lads?
Yeah,
I already gave my prediction. I almost said prescription.
Is it what you actually think we're going to win 1-0?
Dude, I've got a really weird feeling, man. I'm not lying to you guys. I just got a weird feeling that we can do it.
I don't. I'll take whatever prescription you're handing out, Maddie, because you're obviously high. I'll take a 1-0 loss or a 2-0 loss.
Yeah. I'm glad we're on the same page there. But yeah, whatever Maddie's smoking, can send me some as well. That'd be great. You've got to think as well, if we do manage to take points off Juve, you know he's going to be really happy about it.
I know, I thought about that too. Yeah.
Antonio Conte and Inter, so throw the game, lads. We love a bit of match fixing, so. We got an interesting, question, but...
God, hold on, let's just go back to that. How fucked up of a situation is it that it's... Because we know we're not competing for the title, so it's like we might as well throw a game to Juve to prevent Inter from getting points. If we beat Juve, normally we'd be ecstatic, but now that just helps Inter. This is rough.
It's horrendous. Yeah. It's awful, but we can't let Inter win the title. I say we, like we have much say in it, and we haven't already lost to them this season, but Inter can't win it. They can't go one in front of us. That just wouldn't be nice. I mean, even though we're ahead on Champions League and
ultimately, I'd still take the 3 points against Juve. If we magically pull that off, I would be very happy with the 3 points. But
I still think Juve are going to have a bit too much in the Scudetto race because Inter are being forced to work really hard, and I think that their Champions League group stage, in terms of who qualifies, is probably going to come down to the final game. So they're going to be playing two, sometimes three games in 7-day spells at full intensity. And Conte is obviously a very demanding coach, and he asks everyone to put a shift in. And I think that where Inter may come unstuck is perhaps depth in a couple of areas, particularly up front. If one of Lukaku or Lautaro goes down, they don't really have anyone to put up front, because obviously Sanchez is injured. So, I don't know. I still think that eventually Juve will just about start to pull away. But at this point in time, we don't really know what's going to happen. And I'm just scared at the thought of Inter winning number 19, to be honest. But, you know, I mean, we can come back to it and we say we finished 1 point behind Inter last season. Regardless of what you thought of Gattuso, I think he clearly got more out of this squad than what where its actual level was. But at the same time, now with the benefit of hindsight, you can look back and say, okay, the two approaches that the teams took over the summer, we let Gattuso walk away because, you know, disagreements with the board and failure to deliver top four, which ended up not really being as much of a failure as it could have been. And we decided that we needed six new players for 90 million, the oldest being 25 and the majority being 20, 21. And we decided we needed Giampaolo to come in as the new manager and that we needed three new directors in Maldini, Boban and Massara. And what did Inter do? You know, Spalletti went, they went and got a world-class coach in Conte. They spent big money on four players in Barella, Sensi, Lukaku, and then obviously Sanchez came in as well, that were big names. There were some doubts surrounding them, but ultimately they knew that they were investments that were pretty much guaranteed to increase the overall quality of the squad and definitely the depth at the very least. And it's all clicked for them. It's all clicked. It's like there were two diverging paths and we were the ones who took the wrong path. And now here we are. But yeah, anyway, moving on. Sofa King Basic actually asks something which is good in my opinion, because I've thought about this and I think that it could actually work. I don't know if Pioli's going to do this, but he suggests, I'm assuming for the Juve game, potentially going back to a Christmas tree formation where we have a back four of Hernandez, Romagnoli, Duarte and Calabria, the midfield three being Krunic, Benacer and Kessier, then Hakan and Paqueta either side of Piontek or Liao up front. I like that because at the moment, we don't seem to have an abundance of natural wingers who are contributing much. So by having two attacking midfielders in behind, I think that might assist our press a little bit. And also it allows Paqueta to get that freedom where he could potentially be dangerous and creative. And then depending on the opponent that we come up against, you've got a choice of who to play at centre forward. What do you think of the Christmas tree, lads?
I liked it. I was a fan of it when Giampaolo was rocking the Christmas tree. I think that was our best compromise for him, you know, with moving from a 4-3-3 into his 4-3-1-2 or whatever it was he wanted to use. So I thought that was able to get the best of both worlds out of us. I don't think it's a necessary formation to switch to. I don't think we need to do it. I think we should just stick with what we got.
Yeah, I think that the players know a 4-3-3, and I want to stick with that. Simple enough.
It is simple enough, and it's also the formation that Pioli knows. I mean, he knows a 4-2-3-1 as well. I've seen a few call for us to go to three at the back and to just allow Hernandez and Calabria to be wing-backs. So, you know, they're not as responsible defensively. And we've got the cover of playing with three centre-backs. But at the moment, I really don't think we have three good enough centre-backs to do that. It's all right saying, let's play three centre-backs, but they've got to work together and they've all got to be strong defensively and they've got to have certain skill sets. But, you know, doesn't always work out. And I think a lot of what we might see moving forward will... A big indication, should we say, of where this team will be from, you know, with regards to its spine will come when Mattia Caldara returns to full fitness and he might actually be available for the Juve game. You know, obviously he's been training with the rest of the squad. Hasn't played a game competitively since April in that Coppa Italia second leg against Lazio, which I actually went to that one and Correa scored a goal on the counter-attack in the second half to win it. That sounds familiar. But yeah, when Caldara comes back, you got to assume he's going to partner Romagnoli. That may see Duarte moved back out to right back. We don't know how that's going to go. But yeah, well, that's going to be a big thing for me. If Romagnoli and Caldara can click, if they look like they're a pairing that complement each other well, then that's going to be a big part of the battle. I mean, we've conceded at least 2 goals in 6 out of our last 8 games, and that's just not good enough. You know, we had that ridiculous defensive record under Gattuso at the start of the year. I think we had conceded like 7 goals in as of March or something like that. So, you know, we were up there with the top defences in Europe. He got the best out of a back four, which consisted of Calabria, Musaccio, Romagnoli and Ricardo Rodriguez for the most part. He managed to get them keeping clean sheets for fun. And here we are now. You know, the thing that we did consider our strength has now become one of our weaknesses. And our weakness, which was scoring goals and breaking teams down, is now an even bigger weakness. So it's all shit, basically. Right. So a couple more extra questions that we got. And people are, I find this interesting, people are already thinking about the post-Pioli era, which you might think is, you know, looking a bit too far ahead. But there's a couple of interesting suggestions here. And one from Teo Diplas, who asks, Niko Kovac was fired from Bayern Munich. I honestly can't think of a better opportunity to grab him before another team can. What are your thoughts on that?
No.
Yeah, not a chance. He just got beat 5-1 by a relegation side with Bayern Munich. Not a chance.
Frankfurt relegation side.
No, but he has one of the best teams in the world.
He does. He does.
And if he can't make it work with that, he's not going to make it work with a team struggling in Serie A.
I think there needs to be an element of realism about where Bayern Munich are. I'm not an expert in them, but also at the same time, I look at the table. They're in a cluster of teams. So there's Hoffenheim in 9th, who have 17 points. Bayern are in 4th with 18 points. Results go their way on this coming weekend and they beat Dortmund. They'll probably go into outright 2nd place and could go within a point of Mönchengladbach in top. So, like, they're not out of the title race in the Bundesliga at all. And, of course, they won it last season with Kovac in charge. And they got to the Champions League knockout stages and lost to the eventual winners, Liverpool. So, it's like, Bayern Munich have got very, very used to dominance and to being not just the best in Germany, but the best by a distance. But they've done that under Guardiola and they've done that under Ancelotti. The problem is, eventually, like the cycle of world-class coaches who's going to come and join you runs out. So they went for Kovac, who had been very impressive at Eintracht Frankfurt. And funnily enough, Eintracht Frankfurt beat Bayern Munich 5-1 at the weekend to cost Kovac's job. So it is funny how things come full circle in a way. But I think the vast majority think that Kovac has been pretty harshly treated by the Bayern board, being sacked at this point. You know, they're not having an absolutely horrendous start to the season by any means. And perhaps the football isn't as free-flowing as what they've been used to. But ultimately, I guess, Kovac is still learning the trade as well. But yeah, we'll see who they go and get now.
I do want to jump in there because you're right. Obviously, it was Frankfurt. I thought it was Mainz or whatever. I don't even know how to pronounce it.
Oh, no, they got beat 8-0 by Leipzig.
Yeah, we should honestly beat them 6-1. So I was way off on that one.
Yeah, that's an interesting thing, though, because we kept sort of coming back to this idea of, you know, Elliott management, what they want to do with the club in terms of discovering young players that we can develop, blah, blah, blah. You know, we've been over this 1,000 times. But there's perhaps 2-3 clubs around Europe that you would look at and say, if you want to do it and you want to spend the money to go and do it right, then there are clubs where you could go and say, okay, we want your sporting director, we want him to bring the scouting team with him, and then say build whatever you want to build here and do it at a bigger club. I think one of those is Ajax. You know, you could say Ajax, why would anyone from Ajax jump ship to us at the moment? But you know, they've got Marco Overmars and Edwin van der Sar there. They've got a fantastic scouting team, they've got a great youth academy, but it's a youth academy that has brought players in as well and helped bring them through. And yeah, obviously they got to a Champions League semi-final, and were beaten very late on by your boys Spurs. But they're doing things in such an exemplary way, and there's players going for astronomical sums of money now. Obviously, De Jong going for 50 odd mil, De Ligt going for 70 odd mil. It's amazing what they've really done there to transform the club into being back amongst Europe's elite. But you say throw money at them and say come and do that here, and then Leipzig are probably the other ones. You know, they're don't get me wrong, bankrolled by a huge multinational firm in Red Bull, but what they're doing with their young manager there, Julian Nagelsmann, and with a very young squad there as well, is fantastic. The football that they're playing is amazing. And again, you probably say if you're going to go and do it, then you're wanting to try and build something similar, and you're going to make offers for people that are doing what you want to do at a place already, I guess. And ultimately, we've taken gambles apart, you know, aside from doing that, and it hasn't really worked out so far. But Kovac is an interesting name. It'll be interesting as well to see where he ends up next, if he waits for another job in Germany or he does try his luck abroad somewhere. But I don't think he's a terrible manager by any means. Just doesn't always work when you go from a club like Frankfurt to a club that literally expects every single trophy that's available to them. And I've seen something saying that Allegri's actually rejected the Bayern job.
Which, I saw that as well, yeah.
Yeah, that would be kind of mad, because you're wondering then, what is Allegri holding out for? Is he really holding out for a job in the Premier League? When he's made deal about having rest.
United would be the only job I think he would take, because honestly, and no insult to Bayern, but outside of Juve, I feel like that's the easiest job in Europe to take, at least the top levels, you know?
Mm.
Maybe PSG, but
In terms of the league play, yeah.
Yeah, like just the teams that are expected to always win, that always will. Like, I mean, maybe he actually wants a challenge, because United would absolutely be a challenge for him. That's a team in chaos with the same amount of history as us, you know, in terms of like fan desire and demand, that's struggling just a little bit less than we are, with a lot more competition than we have. So I think United is a tough job for him, but you know, he gets that blank check, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I've just seen something suggesting that Thomas Tuchel's in the running to be their next manager, which would be crazy, because he's literally at PSG now, so that'd be a strange sideways move. But Erik ten Hag's an interesting one as well, because he's obviously the current Ajax boss, and he's a manager that was never really mentioned for us. And I don't know, I find that surprising. I think that Ajax is one of those weird clubs where, like, they are a big club and they've got obviously European history and stuff like that, but it would still be considered a step up to join a club like us. So maybe that's where we should have been looking, not Sampdoria. But that's our water under the bridge now, I guess. We got another question here from Lebovic, who asks, when, if at all, do you see a new investor purchasing us from Elliot? Obviously, we know that Elliot's plan, at least medium term, is to increase the value of the club to around about €1 billion with help from the new stadium project and stuff like that, and then eventually flip us. There's been some talk of investment, some from what's he called? Bernard Arnault, who does he own Louis Vuitton?
Yeah, he's right? Like the second richest man in the world.
Yeah, he's cool. But
he also denied any interest multiple times.
He doesn't go away, though, does it? And it makes you wonder if there is, therefore, an element of truth. He's never going to come out and admit there being talks anyway, because if there were talks, then you've got to sign a non-disclosure agreement.
Was his source from Calcio Mercato?
No, because we'd have heard about that, because they're obviously the most reliable, so... yeah. They came out from a couple of places. I found it interesting. One of them went really big and said that he's got this plan of taking over for $750 million,
mm-hmm.
and that Elliot were going to accept that, and that he wanted, as one of his first things, to spend money and bring Max Allegri in, basically. And I liked the sound of that, man. I really did.
Do we know how much Elliot has invested already, though, from the loans that they gave Lee that obviously defaulted? That's money spent. all the investment in players, paying off all of our debt, salaries for everyone, where we are now.
Plus, like, even covering our losses for this past year.
Right. So is $750 million, I mean, is that break even? Is that a loss? Is that a gain? Is it enough of a gain? I mean, really, I see it going one of two ways. Either things continue to just spiral out of control, and Elliot says, let's cut ties. This is not worth it. We're never going to get this club to the 1.5 billion euro valuation we want. Or they buckle down, spend a shit ton more, spending almost $1 billion total, you know, between everything that's already happened, and then sell it for a little bit more than a billion. I mean, I don't see them profiting much anymore, unfortunately. So I think sooner rather than later, I would expect. I know originally they said, like, what they say, like 6 to 8 years they plan on being around, but I just don't see it happening. It's not a good investment for them.
Okay, so I've just found something here that says that Elliott management have so far pumped 625 million euros into the club. 300 million, which was lent to Yong Hong Lee, which he obviously defaulted on paying back, so they've basically had to cover that themselves, plus another 325 million that they've invested, which has obviously gone towards covering losses and various other expenditures. I'm guessing that's net as well, so you know, that factors in the revenue that we've made and stuff like that. But yeah, financially, we don't look to be in the most healthy state, but also you read things that suggest that we're actually in a much more stable position than we were under Yong Hong Lee, because we've got someone who's willing to cover the losses. The actual equity has increased quite a lot, which is a sign of financial strength within a club or within a company. But there is no denying that they are looking to sell us in the, certainly not the long term, but they want to hit a certain valuation before they do that. And they want to do that, I guess, because it's a measuring stick that they've taken us forward, which I have a lot of time for. I respect that. They're not in the business of running football clubs. They've put trust in people, put them in a position of power to try and deliver, you know, the objectives that they think will get the valuation of the club up. And although it may seem a bit shallow, you know, we're talking in money sense about one of the biggest clubs in the world and stuff like that. Ultimately, if the valuation of the club goes up to anywhere near a billion, it most likely coincides with us being up there competing again. It's as simple as that. So if they want to look at it that way, then that's fine by me. Obviously, the new stadium will help as well. I feel like that's going to be Elliott's legacy from everything, is that they're going to kind of take us and into the 21st century by giving us a new state-of-the-art stadium. And that will obviously be a massive thing for us in terms of commercial revenues and stuff like that. But I still think that if someone came along with a respectable offer, then Elliott would kind of be happy to get rid of what is at the moment a mess. But I don't think they're going to walk away without attempting to fix the mess that's kind of unfurled under their tenure so far. It will be interesting to see what our next owners are, you know, to you know, whether it's a consortium, whether it is someone like Bernard Arnault, whether it's a businessman type like Rocco Camisa, whether it's Saudi, whether it's Qatari-led investment. You know, there's all kinds of different possibilities. Admittedly, we're not as attractive a prospect as we perhaps were when Yong Hong Lee came to take over the club the first time, but it is what it is.
One thing that we can't deny, though, is whoever buys us next is going to have huge amounts of money simply based off the valuation and the fact that they've already invested so much. There's no way someone buys this club for $1 billion or however much, you know, they can't afford to continue investment. So that's kind of like the silver lining there, at least in my opinion, the light at the end of the tunnel. But it's, I mean, the fact that they've already spent however much you said, 600 and some, and if Bernard is supposedly looking at 750, that's not much of a jump there. Mm-mm. So that says every player is getting a salary cut who wants to stay. If anyone wants to leave, then, you know, we're going to sell you, and anyone we sign is going to be on freezer low cost, because we can't go above this figure. You know, that whatever the figure is, they set that when they bought the club or when they took over. Nothing's going above that, their expenditure, guaranteed. Because why spend €1 billion, €1.2 billion just to sell it for €1.5 billion, you know, a few years down the road? Is it worth that headache to them? Probably not.
No, definitely not. No. Unless they've delivered something in that period. And, you know, unless the fans love them and think that they've left a good legacy. I do kind of like the way that Elliot are operating at the moment, because they're doing it from a kind of non-sentimental point of view, which seems contradictory in the fact that they've obviously brought back Maldini and Boban to be directors and stuff like that. But they're doing it purely on a looking at the balance sheets and making what they deem to be wise investments, rather than going fully sentimental and spending a lot of money on perhaps bringing back ex-players like Ibrahimovic and stuff like that. Speaking of which, we'll finish this episode by looking at a couple of the Mercato rumours, I guess you call them, with January actually not that far away now. It looks like we're going to be spending some money anyway. La Repubblica said, and there was other places, obviously Vito Angeli, we had an exclusive on our site from him saying that Elliot have basically accepted that they're going to have to stump up some money for a couple of experienced players in January. Marca had an interesting report out on Sunday, I believe it was. I think it was yesterday, saying that Ibrahimovic is most likely to join Milan as his next club. Obviously, there's stuff come out that he's in talks with Bologna. There's even talk that he could renew with the Galaxy and sign another one-year deal there. I'm now fully on board with this. I think we bring him back.
I do too, and I think he's going to kill it.
I'm torn. I love his leadership ability. I love his presence. I don't know if a striker is the necessary investment. I would prefer us to get someone with those qualities at that point in their career in defense and in midfield instead. You know, like a Thiago Silva, Jerome Boateng, Luka Modric. Those names make a lot more sense for our situation than Ibrahimovic. Now, if we sign Ibrahimovic, I'm buying that jersey the day I can, and I'm going to be hyped because it's fucking Zlatan.
Anthony, we can't score goals. Our strikers are not creating chances.
We need someone who...
That's why I think we need midfielders.
We need someone who is going to come in who is not used to losing and absolutely fucking hates losing. Has a ridiculous goal-scoring record, someone who knows the club well, has a proven track record of improving the players around him, someone who's a leader, who's going to say, you know, follow what I do, lads. We need someone who's arrogant, someone who's a bit nasty, someone who's not, you know, who's willing to do...
He will get in their faces on the pitch and be like, you're fucking up, fix it.
There's no word that I can really use to describe the way that Zlatan seems to lift teams. I mean, we've seen it with us. I personally think we've had much better teams that didn't win the Scudetto than the one that did in 2010-11. You know, as we've mentioned before, we had sort of the likes of Robinho, who had a really good season for us, Nocerino. We had quite an old core of players there. But Ibrahimovic just, he basically won us it on his own. And that is he's got an elite mentality. He's a warrior. And as I said, loves the club. And I think if we put an acceptable contract offer out there, he might fancy it. He might. But the further that we slip down the hole that we're in at the moment, you know, if we're in 14th place by the start of January, I don't think he touches us with a barge pole. But if we're on our way back up and he thinks he can come in and make a difference, and this is his last hurrah doing something in Europe for the club that he says that he loves the most, then I think he'll do it. I mean, Cassano said, and I think he's still good friends with Ibra. I could be wrong on that, but Cassano said today that he thinks that if Milan put down an 18-month contract offer for Zlatan, so, you know, till the end of the season plus one more, then he'll probably sign it. So we'll wait and see. But I'd like it because I think it fills a number of gaps that we're looking for in terms of leadership, as you say, in terms of having a proven goal scorer. It ticks a lot of boxes for us at the moment. And Piontek and Liao can learn from a player like that. It's all about mentoring as well.
Now, remember, though, with the Spalletti issue, it was €500,000 reason why we just said, no, we're not going to help out over this little bit amount of money. Zlatan currently is making $7.2 million in America, which equals out to €6.5 million. If our cap is $4 million, I mean, are we really going to budge for that for a 38-year-old? I don't think Elliot will. The fans would, absolutely, and most clubs would. But I don't, like you said, Elliot's not sentimental.
No, that's correct. It depends, though, on how badly they view this crisis. I think a lot of the reports that have come out suggest that Elliot realized now that we're in shit, and that potentially limiting the kind of investments that they make is actually only going to to put only going to put a constraint on their decision making. They haven't had a problem doing that in the past, and they trusted in doing that over the summer. But as I say, I think they realise now that we need leaders, we need experience, we need players that are going to help raise the level of what is a very young team that is psychologically damaged, quite frankly, at the moment. And you don't bring in experienced top level players for $3 million a year salary. It just doesn't happen. So if you can perhaps not pay as much out on a transfer fee, but you've got a bigger wage to, you know, I don't know. I think it makes sense. And I think they may make exceptions. But the problem that then has is if we bring in Ibrahimovic on 8-10 mil a year until the end of 2021 or whatever, and then we're negotiating Donnarumma's renewal with Raiola, he's going to say, well, you give us 8 mil as well. You know, it does kind of set a dangerous precedent, but I think there will be exceptions to it where we have to just bite the bullet and pay these players what they want, because that extra 2 million a year salary to bring in somebody who you would consider to be a player with, as I say, elite level experience, then you're going to do it because it's exactly what we need at the moment.
Yeah, I think we'll have to take care of all those renewals with Raiola specifically before signing anyone, you know. And Raiola's a Latin guy too, actually, so he's going to know anyways. You can't sneak it. But I was thinking Romagnoli, because he's just signed with Raiola. Obviously, he's going to try and push for a bonus all of a sudden. Donnarumma wants an increase, you know. And then who else do we have that's Raiola? There's a few other people. I can't remember. But, you know, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
If Zlatan comes in after that too, then they're like, well, look, if we're paying this guy this, then we need to be paying him that.
Could also potentially work in our favor, though, if Raiola says, oh, if you play Zlatan this, then I'll convince Gigio to sign at 6 mil a year again or something like that.
That's a good point. It's a really good
point. That's pure speculation, obviously. But we'll
see. But it's not outside the realm of possibility. I mean, that
no,
happens.
Absolutely not. I also don't see the Donnarumma thing ending well at all. I really don't. I think the demands are going to be high, and that's understandable because he's one of the best goalkeepers in Europe, let alone one of the best young goalkeepers in Europe. I don't think we're going to be able to get him for anything near the four to five mil that we're supposedly offering. Like, who takes a pay cut when they're improving at that kind of level? It doesn't make any sense. The player that we keep getting linked with, I haven't really asked you too much about him, but what do you think of Rodrigo De Paul or De Paul? Even
I was for it over the summer, but I don't think that's the character profile we need to be looking for this January.
I agree. We need a bigger statement.
I think he's a very good player. I like him. Of course, he came off the bench in the opening game of the season and got an assist with his first kick when Udinese beat us. But I think he's good. I think his stats don't lie. He's been a very, very good player for Udinese. In this current situation, as you say, AJ, we need players that are going to come in and raise the level. We don't need players who are going to need time to adapt and adjust to the bigger expectations. I also don't really know what his role would be in this current system. You know, he's used to playing in a three at the back formation, and I don't know where you stick him. Is he an out-and-out winger? Probably not. Is he an out-and-out midfielder? He can play as a box-to-box midfielder, I guess, but then you're talking about dropping Paqueta. So I don't know if it's a particularly a worthwhile investment, but it's worth monitoring because it seems like we are really interested in him. What else have we got? A couple of centre-backs we've been linked with. Rugani's one of them. I'm going to go straight off the bat and say no, this wouldn't make much sense.
Yeah, absolutely no.
He's just not playing consistent minutes at all. He's had fitness problems just as Caldara has, so I'd much rather take the chance with Caldara than go for Rugani. Demiral's name keeps popping up though.
Yeah, I've always had positive things to say about him and was down with us splashing the 38 or whatever Juve asked for over the summer. The only issue with it was that he's a Juve player, and it's like, do we really want to give them almost $40 million for a player that they have on their bench that they bought last window for, what was it, like $8 million, something like that? That's the only thing. But as far as his ability, he would help us immensely. I think he's a good player. He's tall, he's strong, and he's a good defender, so if that's who we choose to go for, I think it would help us. I think he instantly starts over Musacchio.
Yeah, 100%, yeah. The interesting thing I think about the centre-back situation is, obviously, a lot of it depends on Caldara. If he comes straight into the starting lineup and doesn't appear to be much of an improvement on what we have, perhaps he's still suffering with the injury and that kind of thing. if we're then going to go for a centre back, do you go for somebody who is basically Caldara's replacement, like a Demiral, someone around about the same age, or do you say, okay, this is a chance to bring in a player with experience, go for a Boateng, or I don't know, there's plenty of names out there that you could potentially go and get. But yeah, that'd be an interesting one. And then in the midfield, the rumours seem to be sort of split between getting Modric, Rakitic, or I've seen Arturo Vidal's name mentioned in one report, and I'd really like Vidal. I think
I'd take Rakitic over Vidal, though.
Would probably cost
I'd go
a
Vidal
lot less.
Over. Wait, who do you think would cost less?
I think Rakitic would cost less than Vidal.
Really? I think Vidal would.
I think Vidal would cost less,
but I think that Rakitic is a more versatile midfielder, where Vidal is just simply a centered defending mid.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just basing it on the fact that Rakitic hasn't been playing much this season, whereas Vidal's started pretty much all of Barcelona's big games this season. Obviously, Vidal's been, well, they've both been pretty heavily linked with Inter, but yeah, I don't know. Vidal, of course, is 32. Rakitic is 31, I think. So they're both players that, you know, have experience and have played for top-level clubs, but just don't know if we have the money to go in and bring in a statement midfield signing. I think we probably have to sell in order to get a deal like that over the line. But who knows? It depends what Elliot have planned, really. So, I think that's everything.
Yeah, I think, like we mentioned, Inter realized they needed two or three little world-class players to really finish the puzzle. I think we need like four or five. So if we could get two of the three midfielders we just named, one of the defenders we just named, and probably Zlatan, then I think we have a chance of clawing back. I think Champions League's already gone, though, at this point.
It is, and that does make me worried that Elliot might say, okay, this is a bit of a write-off and already start to look at next summer. Mm-hmm. That then makes me fear about where we finish this season, because as I've said multiple times on this podcast before, not scared about finishing, you know, fifth or sixth, scared about finishing something like 10th or 12th, you know,
but
which is roughly where we're
positive now. Though, you know, I mean, because as the fans, we've basically already written it off. So what if they sign, you know, world-class younger players on freeze in January for next season? Then at least we have something to look forward to, you know?
That'd be cool. Yeah.
I don't
cool. A lot of the best projects have kind of been built a few months in advance. You know, I can think of, you know, plenty of examples where teams have kind of written off a season and just been looking ahead to the summer about who they can bring in, the players that they'll be able to get rid of, the players that they may have back from injury, a coach that they may be able to get in to take them to the next level. You know, sometimes you can build excitement for the next season, you know, a few months before, and that might be where we're looking at now. But I don't know. I'm just a little bit worried that Elliot aren't going to put up the funds that are needed to make this team competitive with the other top teams. And nor really should they. I guess the problem as well is that Pioli's in charge. So if Pioli's the one who has a say in who he wants to go out and sign, do you really see him staying beyond the season? I mean, there's literally a clause in his contract that says he leaves if he doesn't get us into Europe. So are you really going to trust him to go and spend 50, 60 million? Or are you putting it all in Maldini and Boban's hands? And you can say that their recruitment over the summer is enough reason to suggest they don't deserve to spend that kind of money. Don't know. Bit of a mess from top to bottom. And on that rather positive note, I guess we'll tie it up for this week. And we'll come back in a week's time, probably with another defeat under our belts. But who knows? I guess stranger things have happened. But for the meantime, I've been your host, Ollie Fisher. You can find me on host... God. You can tell it's late. It's 12:15 here. I've been your host, Ollie Fisher. You can find me on Twitter at Ollie Fisher or at Kilpin Chronicle for some more explicit Milan-based rants. And I've been joined once again by Anthony Torgrud.
Yeah, it's actually been enjoyable to be on the pod, even though we've only talked about negativity. It's nice to know I'm not alone, and I'm sure everyone listening is not alone in this feeling. But you can find me on Twitter at Torgrud45. And Madison, take it away.
Yeah, you guys can go ahead and find me on Twitter at Madison_DT.
Thank you very much for listening, everybody, and we will catch you in a week's time.
Patrick, mettila in mezzo, Patrick. Palla nostra, Suso, tira Alessio, Suso, tira. Perché non tiriamo? ma perché non tiriamo gol? Alessio Romagnoli, gol! Alessio Romagnoli! Alessio! Il gol del capitano ancora! Ancora l'ultimo, come Gilardino, detto ieri in conferenza.